Welcome to The Table Podcast, where we discuss questions regarding race, ethnicity, culture, norms, and current events. My name is Rosemary Ferreira.
And my name is Courtney Jones Carney. This past year, the Intercultural Center made the decision to use the term Southwest Asian and North African, or SWANA, to honor students, staff, faculty, and community members from countries such as Egypt, Iran, Afghanistan, and Syria during the month of April.
So I'm just going to quickly slip back in here to say that both Courtney and I mispronounced Iran quite a few times in our intro to this episode, and we wanted to apologize for that. The correct pronunciation is Iran and Iranian. You'll hear the correct pronunciation from our guest Sama in a little bit.
In previous years, we used terms such as Arab and Middle Eastern, but were called in by community members who shared that these terms weren't inclusive of the wide variety of ethnic groups, languages, and cultures within the region. We decided to move forward with SWANA because it is a decolonized term that centers geography rather than a history of European colonialism and American imperialism. By focusing on geography, it is also more inclusive of the various cultural histories that exist within the region.
Courtney and I wanted to know more about the evolving language used to identify these communities, as well as how SWANA or MENA, which is shorthand for Middle Eastern and North African people, are racialized in the U.S. Why are they simultaneously being invisibilized by being grouped under white in the U.S. Census and yet hyper-visibilized by being targeted and discriminated against in everyday life for not being white? Why isn't there a distinct MENA or SWANA category in the census? What implications does this have for resources and funding towards these communities? And if MENA or SWANA does become its own category, would it be considered a race or an ethnicity? If we rewind back in history, we will see that in the first waves of immigration from the SWANA region in the early 20th century, many ethnic groups from the SWANA region, including Arabs and Armenians, actively pursued whiteness in legal courts. And if you've listened to our previous episodes, you'll know that whiteness was, and still is, tied to prestige, power, opportunity, and the liberties of full citizenship in the U.S. The court ruled in favor of designating SWANA people as white because many of the first immigrants from the SWANA region were Christian, and were therefore viewed as more likely to assimilate into American society. These early rulings cemented the U.S. Census Bureau's current classification of SWANA people as white. However, today, many members of SWANA communities, particularly U.S.-born children of SWANA immigrants, are arguing the opposite. They do not see themselves as white, and this is often because they are experiencing anti-Arab, anti-Iranian, and/or anti-Muslim discrimination and violence in the U.S. Later waves of immigration from the SWANA region in the mid to late 20th century were increasingly Muslim, and political events throughout history, such as the Iranian hostage crisis in 1979 and the September 11th attacks in 2001, has resulted in a hyper-visibilization of SWANA people as violent and barbaric. Cue that opening song to the Disney movie Aladdin, Arabian Nights.
I come from a land, from a faraway place, where the caravan camels roam. Where it's flat and immense and the heat is intense. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home.
Without proper data and representation, the stories and lived experiences of SWANA people are often hidden from mainstream media. What we get instead are narratives, like Aladdin, that are steeped in stereotypes that are harmful to SWANA communities. Today, the lack of census data results in a hodgepodge of studies for specific ethnic groups within the SWANA region. For example, one study of Arab Americans done by the Arab American Institute Foundation used data from the 2017 American Community Survey to estimate a population of about 2 million Arab Americans in the U.S. But the study states that this number is likely significantly lower than the actual number of Arab Americans, which they estimate is more than 3.5 million people. However, this number also excludes non-Arab Swana people such as Iranians and Afghans. Advocacy groups such as Yella Count Me In have been fighting for MENA classification for the 2020 census, but the proposal was rejected by the Census Bureau because they needed more research for the change.
So to answer the myriad of questions that I listed earlier, I hit up a friend of mine and fellow alum of the University of Maryland College Park Student Affairs Program, Salma Sahibi. Salma identifies as Iranian American and wrote her master's thesis on the invisibilization of Iranian students and Middle Eastern students more broadly within higher education and other societal institutions in the U.S. Here she is introducing herself and her family story.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me. I'm so happy and excited to be here. My name is Salma Sahibi. I use she, her pronouns. I met Rosemary through the UMD College Park Student Affairs Program, where I now am as a program coordinator. But I was actually born and raised in Northeast Ohio, outside of Youngstown, if anyone knows where that's from. And I ended up going to Ohio State for my undergrad, where I studied neuroscience and had a very big change in my career path and became really interested in education policy, specifically at the collegiate level. I was really interested in creating equitable learning spaces at institutions. And so I became super interested in higher education student affairs. I identify as an Iranian American, and both of my parents are from Iran. My mom actually was sent here with a one-way ticket when she was 15 years old to come study. It was before the Iranian Revolution back in 1979. So that is where she was. Meanwhile, my father won a lottery to study in the United States for veterinary school. And so he actually was leaving Iran also around the time of the revolution. And he left only a few days after the hostage crisis in 1979. And he actually got stopped and had to live in Costa Rica for 2 years, where he worked on a farm and kind of got those veterinary skills, I guess. But anyway, ultimately, he ended up coming to Ohio. And that's where him and my mom met and got married. They moved to Northeast. And that's where I grew up. And where I grew up, we were one of the very few, if not only, Middle Eastern families in a large radius. And that was really important for me because the only community I had was with my immediate family or extended family, both in terms of culture, but then also my family is Baha'i, the Baha'i faith. So we can talk more about that later. But I grew up around a lot of Greek and Italian folks, and so they're Catholic and Christian. And so that was also a different experience for me. And it wasn't until later in like middle school that my parents would drive us to Cleveland every week to get together with a larger Baha'i community. And so those are really foundational years for me, starting to figure out kind of who I am and, oh, there's other people here in the world that look like me. In the United States that aren't that far, both in terms of being Middle Eastern, but also that are part of the Baha'i faith. And so when I went to Ohio State, it was really an amazing experience because it's a huge university. It was like 70,000 people over there. And I started to become more involved with the Iranian community and culture there and realized how much I missed out on because of where I grew up. And I also became part of a larger Baha'i community and again realized how much I missed out on because I wasn't near a community and didn't have some of that like formalized, you know, religious experience or cultural experience because my parents also worked really hard to assimilate into the fabric of, you know, the environment that we were in, which was predominantly white and Christian. And so it was definitely during undergrad that I was like changing a lot and kind of realizing some of the things that I missed out on, some of the things that I wanted. And by the end of my undergrad, I was like, I'm really passionate about identity formation and students and sense of belonging. And so I was like, okay, I don't know what I want to do with neuroscience because I don't want to go to med school. And I saw my sister doing research and I was like, I don't want to do that. And I realized that my undergrad could just be that, you know, my undergrad, something that I am interested in, but it didn't have to be my life. And what I really cared about was, like I said, higher education. That's also a big part of my religion, is education, equity for men and women. So that was something that I was just passionate about. I took a year off. I worked for the Columbus Metropolitan Library during that time, and again, became more part of my community. And applied to grad school, where I ended up at Maryland, and I ended up doing my thesis work on specifically Iranian students, but under the larger context of Middle Eastern racialization, and ended up getting a job and working for University of Maryland College Park now, where I'm program coordinator.
Thank you so much for sharing that and for sharing, you know, like your life journey. And I definitely relate to, you know, my higher education experience really being the place where I was able to really formulate or think more critically about who I am and what my identity is, right? And have that space. And I think that's why I also decided to get my master's degree in student affairs, because I was like, hey, higher ed is like really transformative. Yeah. And I really want to make sure that for other students, especially for students of color, navigating predominantly white spaces, that we are able to develop a space of belonging and a space of healing and figuring out who we are. And so you mentioned your master's thesis, and I would love to hear more about your work and some of the findings of your work.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, what you just said was so powerful too. You know, that's exactly, and that ties into my thesis, is I totally realized that higher education was a place and a space that was transformative and that you could learn more about yourself. And I wanted everyone to have that opportunity to be there and take advantage of that. And so, you know, I'm in student affairs. I started my first semester and, you know, we're reading about all sorts of students with different, with diverse identities, different backgrounds, ethnic, racial, sexual, you know, and I'm just like, I was learning so much and it was amazing. And the whole time though, I'm like waiting and I'm waiting and I'm like, when do y'all think we're going to talk about Middle Eastern students? You know, like, when is this going to come up? And I would be reading some of the best scholars' work and like flipping through these books and never once even see the word come up. Right. And so it was kind of frustrating, right? Like, I'm like, okay, I'm finally in this space where the whole purpose is to understand students, their sense of belonging, their identity, but there is a whole population missing. Once again, I'm in a space where I'm invisible, you know, and I think it was more hurtful too, because you're in a place that is intended to see you, right? Like, you're in a profession that intends to create that sense of belonging for you, that, you know, a profession where you're trying to uplift students. And I'm like, well, we can't even do that if they're not even being named, you know, nowhere. And so it was definitely frustrating. And I was like, why aren't we learning about this? And so for me, taking on a thesis, of course I wanted to, because I wanted that work to get out there. But it was a lot of questioning for me is, does anyone care? Is this worth it? Does it even matter? Because how have we gone so long without even bringing it up? So I had to get over that, you know, so many times. Whenever it got hard, I was like, nobody even cares except me. but as I continued through my process, talking with my participants, I'm like, this matters and I have to do this. And so for my thesis, really it starts by approaching higher ed by saying like, okay, a lot of times universities are a step ahead of society, right? Like, a lot of people see them as more progressive. And so I'm like, okay. And as we know, higher education universities are very big on retention and student support. And so where's the gap? And higher education, like, they follow the same demographic structure that the census follows. And so what that means is there's no checkbox for Middle Eastern students. They are checking white. And so we have no data. We have no idea how many Middle Eastern students are at any one university that doesn't collect that data. We don't know what their graduation rates are. We don't know retention. We don't know what resources they need. We don't know anything. And this was so powerful because as I was in the height of my thesis, like last spring, I went to ACPA and which is a conference for student affairs professionals, and Kimberly Crenshaw was the speaker. She said something. She goes, "What doesn't get measured doesn't count." And that just like was exactly what I needed to hear at that moment. And it was so powerful because I'm like, you know, I don't count. And it just seemed so hypocritical, antithetical to what universities were trying to do. And so that was kind of the justification for like, let's look at this at the higher education level, right? Because I could write all day about why doesn't the United States do this, but I work in higher ed. Higher ed has historically taken that step forward. Why aren't they doing it now when they can? As I'm doing this research, I'm realizing that the only information that's out there about this population has to do with Muslim students. And that was very angering, right? Because we're homogenized enough. And so they're just like, all Middle Eastern people are Muslim and all Muslim students have the same issues. But there's a quote by Neda Makbule, who wrote The Limits of Whiteness, and I actually have it here. She says, "The contemporary use of Islamophobia as a catch-all term for discrimination against Middle Easterners efficiently but erroneously flattens the extent of diversity within these groups, and more importantly, critically obscures the consistent racial valence of such harassment." So I have received discrimination. I have so many different examples throughout my life. I'm not Muslim, but because I'm a brown woman and because of, you know, how I appear, that is where that comes from, right? But we don't talk about that. We just want to paint it with a broad stroke and just say it's Islamophobia. And so that has really done us a disservice. So again, during that research process, seeing that all of the literature had to do with Islamophobia, like it was helpful, but it really wasn't taking the conversation where it needed to go, which was about racism. Does that make sense? And so my thesis really looked at how did second generation Iranians reconcile their racial identity as it's informed by their family, their peers, and the education system. And I focused on Iranians because there's a lot of diversity within Iranians, both like religiously, culturally, and because of kind of the alignment with Europe and political issues. Also, I'm Iranian, so research is me search. So there's a few reasons there, but it definitely was meant to give me more insight to the racialization broadly of Middle Eastern populations.
Thank you for sharing that. Before I get into a question that I have for you, I do have like a clarifying point. And so you said that you looked at second generation. And so are you talking about second generation U.S. born, or are you talking about, because, you know, like when we talk about a lot of times in higher education, we're having conversations about first gens, and we're talking about individuals whose parents have or have not attended college. So you're talking more about U.S. citizenship, born in the U.S.?
Yes. Yes. Thank you for that clarification. Mm-hmm.
And then you mentioned no one cares except for me, and thinking about, you know, while you were going through the process of convincing yourself that this was a topic that was relevant, you're constantly second guessing yourself and wondering if there are other people who care. And so when we, you know, think about the way that census information has been collected, Middle Eastern folks have fallen under the category of white. However, there have been plenty of activists who have been advocating for MENA or SWANA to appear on the census. And so can you talk a little bit about the development of MENA, SWANA, the shift away from the term just Middle Eastern on its own, or any other information that you wanted to share related to that?
Yeah. So Middle East is what, at least from a Western point of reference, we understand like the Middle East as the countries like Iran, Iraq, Syria, like that region of the world. And it includes, you know, something that I think is important to note is that Arabs and non-Arab groups, which would be Turks, Iranians, Israelis, they are ethnic groups within what would be potentially a racial categorization of MENA. I've seen people try to add the category and write Arab. And again, similar to, you know, religion, not all Middle Eastern people are Arab, right? So if you're Arab, you speak Arabic, and right, Arab is also a culture, but Iranians speak Farsi. Turks speak Turkish, right? So again, there's that difference there. So Middle Eastern would be the umbrella term that encaptures those ethnic groups. There's a lot of countries that fall under that, but you did mention SWANA. So SWANA is a newer term. I've only seen it in academic references recently, more and more recently, I should say. And this came about because people want to depart from this Eurocentric conception of the Middle East. Like, what is, it's not Middle East of anything. It's Middle East of the United States and Europe or UK, right? But geographically speaking, it is Southwest Asia. And so SWANA is Southwest Asia and North Africa. North Africa is included, again, because of the cultural similarities and countries that speak Arabic. Again, so that's part of that. SWANA also, I think because, again, we're talking about a geographical region, it captures more countries than MENA does. So it is a broader region. I want to say the UC, University of California system has adopted this term for their students. I personally like it better. However, you know, it's kind of like Latinx, right? Like, it's an academic term, but if you're on the street, you know, people don't know what that is, right? And so I don't know that having a SWANA category quite yet would make sense for everyone if it's accessible. And something else to note is I saw that article about, you know, if there was a MENA category, that there'd be a large drop off from people that would traditionally have to choose white, they would end up picking MENA. But there has been conversations about folks not wanting to leave the white category, right? So that's important to note because for several reasons, right? One that's been talked about is that Middle Eastern folk don't want a target on their back. And so they think by putting themselves in that box, in that category of Middle Eastern, that is going to cause more discrimination towards them. At some level, there is a protection of claiming you are white. And so there is privilege that comes with that, and we can't ignore that either. When the category was created, I mean, when more and more Middle Eastern people immigrated to the United States, they wanted to be white because of the privileges that were afforded if you were white, right? Like land, property, voting, all of those things. We now see that we're not getting those privileges, but we're forced to, not those privileges, but, you know, we're not getting the benefits, right, that come with quote unquote white privilege, but we're also being discriminated against. But, you know, if we think about like hate crimes and racial crimes, like we can't say this was a race-based hate crime because technically we're white. So it's just, it's like a catch-22, you know, nothing, there's no benefit from it. So it's really difficult. I think something else important to note is for those that do want to hold on to the category white, from my understanding, that's more of a generational thing, right? So my parents, when they came during the hostage crisis, right, there might be more of an interest or willingness to identify as white because of the violence that was associated with that time. Whereas more and more folks in what I shared earlier, the second generation, want to be identified as Middle Eastern because they, you know, they go through school and they're like, I'm not white, right? Like it is very apparent that my experience is different from my white peers. I think that that's important to note as we're thinking about the racial categorization, but we will have to wait another 10 years for the next census.
Yeah, I wanted to highlight, you know, you made the comparison to the Latinx community, and I see a lot of parallels between, you know, the MENA, the SWANA community, and the Latinx community. And so I know part of my question was thinking about some of the previous relationships that I have had, you know, I mean, someone who identified as Black and Arab, right? So racially they identified as Black, but ethnically as Arab. And then I've also known folks who are perceived as white, but were born in Palestine, born and raised in Palestine, yeah. Palestinian roots. And so there's this like racial identity crisis that they're experiencing in terms of, you know, I don't see myself as a white person, but I am being perceived as white. Mm-hmm. I did have a question as to, you know, if we move forward with this MENA SWANA category, which I think is critical that we do, would it fall under a racial category or would it fall under an ethnic category?
Yeah, I've seen people talk about having kind of like the white and then subcategory, like they have like Hispanic. You know, the thing is that do we even know the back end of that? Like why that's even like that now? We know that racial categories have changed multiple times for every group except white. Like I think whites changed maybe once or twice. And I would say that MENA should be its own racial category. I would argue for that. Because why would it be under white? You know, yes, there are people that are white passing or not, but that's something in a lot of different racial categories, right? And things are different too. If you see a white passing person who's wearing a hijab, right, like that also reads differently. So there's so much complexity there. And the truth is, racial categories, I mean, is creating a MENA category the end all be all? I don't know. Like, is that the end goal? Or is it more important to critique that whole system in the first place? But the reason that we want it is because we know that $400 billion are allocated from census data towards education, towards healthcare, towards local, state, and federal programs, and it shapes the political landscape. And so if you have no idea how many Middle Eastern people are in your country, or your state, or your local community, then you have no idea how many translators you need at a hospital or a voting center. You have no idea how to wrap your mind around hate bias incidents, right? So at some degree, yes, we need it. But to the point of what does it mean for those that end up identifying as MENA, you know, that's a big question mark right now, like how that trickles down. And yeah, so I mean, I do think that it should be a racial category on its own, because right now, I took a screenshot of when I filled out the census just last spring. It was, again, like 2 weeks before my thesis. I was like, this is great timing. And it's like, you check white, and then you're asked to write in your ethnic group. And again, I have no idea what happens to that, right? Because I could write Iranian, but someone else could write Persian. Someone else could write Middle Eastern. Someone else could write Southwest Asian, right? Like, is that just getting thrown away? You know, we know in higher ed, when there's not enough of a number, it's thrown out or it's aggregated to other with like whoever else didn't fit in the boxes that were there. I guess to answer your question, I would say yes, there should be a racial category just because we know what comes from knowing your numbers, right? So those resources. But what does that mean for discrimination towards this community? What does that mean for support for this community? Like, we don't know.
So this is where it gets kind of complicated for me. And clearly, I'm not the expert. I'm a Black woman. I just keep thinking about, for folks who identify as MENA and are identifying with North Africa, but then also might select Black, does it erase them altogether? And does it, you know, are we missing some of the complexities?
That's a good question. And that's something that honestly, even I haven't thought too much about. I have friends who are multiracial and talk about how that whole, you know, that system in itself is complicated and people use it different ways, right? Like we know, I've seen reports that will just put them into one of the category if they check three, like they'll just pick one, right? Like what? Or they'll put them in the other category or two or more races, right? Everyone kind of does that differently. And you're right, to some degree, it is erasing an experience there, right? So I know Somali folks who are Black, like appear Black, and they're also wearing a hijab, right? So culturally, there's that. And it's just hard to conceptualize what that is. Yeah, when you're picking more categories, and I guess I would say it depends on how whatever organization creates this sort of demographic set is using that sort of data. And I don't know that there's a good answer, but it's definitely absolutely worth considering how that plays out, because for sure, you know, my lived experience is different than someone who's more white passing is different than someone who is North African or Black, and culturally, you know, whether it be because of religion or language or whatever, would also fit in the MENA category.
Yeah, and we've been discussing Mina, but we haven't really defined Mina as much as I think we should maybe do so. And so can you talk about what are the communities that fall under Mina? I think you did address this a little bit earlier when talking about, you know, Arabs and also Turkish folks, but can you just define it for us?
It is similar to SWANA, right? There's just a couple more countries that are part of that. And again, because the Eurocentric definition is different, right? But under MENA, so let's say we have Arab communities. This is referring to the culture and ethnic groups who speak Arabic are from the Arabian Peninsula and within that region, right? And then we have non-Arab MENA people who largely, and I'm sure I'm missing some other ethnic communities or groups, but largely what comes to mind is Iranians who speak Farsi, like I said, Turks who speak Turkish and Israelis. And so they're distinct from Arabs largely because of language. So that's like a big thing, is linguistic barrier. And the communities or the countries that make up this category is Afghanistan, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Georgia, Iran, Iraq, Israel, Jordan, Kurdistan, Kuwait, Lebanon, Oman, Palestine, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Turkey, Yemen. Those are just the Eurasian countries. And then we also, for North African, SWANA would include Algeria, Egypt, Libya, Morocco, Somalia, Sudan, and Tunisia. And people have different definitions, right? So again, I may or may not be missing a couple countries in there that fall into that geographical region. But I just listed a lot of countries. And so if we think about that, like all of those people are being categorized right now as white. That is a huge, I didn't count, but that's a several countries and populations that are here that are not being counted, that are being homogenized, that are being erased, invisibilized, whatever you want to call it. We have no insight to their experience. People have estimated that there's anywhere between 2 to 6 million MENA people living in the United States. That's a big range. There's just no understanding of that. And so that's so important, especially when we think about the travel ban, the Muslim ban. Like that was a huge thing under the last administration that I actually don't feel like enough people were talking about. And it really impacted students, right? So if we think about international students, yes, they have exceptions because they're on a student visa. But the reality is that because of sanctions on banks, these students weren't able to send money to their home countries, to their families. They're not able to receive money. So imagine being an international student that just had to spend all of this money to come to the United States to study. You have no money to send your family. You have no way to receive money to your family. You also, it's very difficult to work on an F1. I believe the first year you're not even allowed to work unless you're on a campus. And so again, student affairs, like, does everyone know this? Where can we hire F1s? And then you have to get all this approval in order to be able to work. We have no idea how that impacted international students that were here studying. Did they leave? You know, could they come back? Could they not afford to go to school here? And that was so infuriating, even in my own work. You know, I work at the College of Engineering, and I would have Iranian students come and in Farsi tell me, like, I can't afford to live. Like, I don't have any money. I can't get money. I can't send money. I need a grad assistantship. And I would do my best, contact literally every office or contact that I had to be like, can you hire this person? Because they cannot afford food. And there's only so much emergency funding to go around for grad students. And we all know, like, grad students are very much underserved in a lot of ways. But I think a lot about how international students make up a larger proportion of grad students too. Now, the travel ban, the Muslim ban, has been lifted under our current administration, but the impact is still there. I was lucky enough to have a conversation with Neda Makhule in the fall. And, you know, she was talking about doing research on how this ban is creating a generational gap, right? It's cutting the diaspora in the United States, right? So like there is going to be more and more Middle Easterners who lose that language, who lose pieces of that culture because this has really broken up families. And so it really has had a ripple effect. Also, the executive order that allowed that to happen is still there. And it's been historically used to exclude, remove many communities of color from the United States. And so it's definitely a conversation that still needs to be had. I mean, yes, it was celebratory and it was great. I was so happy to see that that was lifted, one of the first things, but also it's not like 4 years went by and nothing happened to those communities. Very detrimental.
Yeah, I feel like it's like the bare minimum was that it was lifted, right?
And yeah,
the work is that it needs to be, you know, there needs to be a consideration for the harm that it caused. Absolutely. And I think that you're bringing up a lot of great points on the struggles that folks within the MENA community are experiencing. As you mentioned, by not being counted, you're not getting the resources that you need. I wanted to ask you if there were any other additional things that we should consider as higher education professionals while working with MENA or SWANA students. And again, acknowledging that this is not a homogenous community, but still thinking about, you know, what are things that we should consider while working with students?
I think one is just being knowledgeable, right? There's so many student affairs professionals and people within like the realm of social justice work and racial justice work who I love and respect so much. And this hasn't been something on their mind, which, you know, sometimes like we don't know what we don't know or what we don't experience. And it's like, when I tell people, they're like, oh my God, like I never even thought about that. And so one, I think it's important to recognize how many students that this really affects. And I mean, you can tap on a Middle Eastern student that you're close with and be like, hey, like, I just realized this. And I am sure I can guarantee that they will rattle off that this has been a point of frustration for them in their lives. Like when I know for me, like when I applied to universities and when I was taking the ACT, like that was the first moment I was like, I don't know what I am. Am I Asian? I was like, I never thought white, you know, like I was just like other, I guess. And so, yeah, I think it's important to be educated how you can, not just with the conversations about like who and what are Middle Easterners and what does that mean, but also the politics around it, because it is very, politics really shape and impact this community in the United States. You know, the Iran nuclear deal, all of these things have, the Muslim ban have really impacted how students navigate their daily life and their relationships with close family. So yeah, education. I think something I would love to see in my life is more and more multicultural centers have a person just like they would for the AAPI community, just like they would for the Black Latinx community, indigenous communities, for a SWANA or MENA person. Like I said, I've been at two universities and we haven't had that yet. There are students that will come in contact with our office and be like, hey, what like grant can I apply for? Or how can I get money? And oftentimes it's left up to the students to figure out their own thing because we don't have the resources for them. So thinking about, you know, where in student services there is a need, counseling centers, you know, affinity groups, again, they're not there. So that would be important. I think also when we're thinking about scholarship, it's important to have a intersectionality framework. So like I said, religion is often tied to this conversation about race, but they're different, but they cannot be separated too, right? A lot of the time you have to think about both of those and how religion is racialized in a lot of ways. So that, and disaggregate SWANA or MENA from white, right? Like I've never understood what powers there are that make that impossible, you know, at the university level. Like who is the person in charge? Where do I find them? And why can't we just add this? You know, I know that for reports and funding and grants and all that stuff, a lot of times we have to restructure to fit the census, right? But for our university purposes, what's stopping us from having a category? What's the harm? You know, who is being protected by having them aggregated? Who's not? You know, who's it really benefiting? I think those questions are really important to ask. So yeah, those would be my top three wishes, is just start to really make these students visible they're there. They're just a lot of times not being considered, and they need a lot of the support and resources that other students of color are getting. And I think the last 4 years especially was a missed opportunity for that, but there's no reason that we can't make change moving forward.
So I'm generally not a naive person. I'm thinking though, and I could be wrong, right? There could be malicious intent and, you know, all sorts of thought behind this. But I'm honestly thinking that many institutions, specifically like these departments of institutional research, haven't even given it any thought about not including this population in white. And so I could be wrong, but I think that it is just a lack of even looking at the experiences of different populations that are falling under white and then determining, does this even make sense? And I think that what you mentioned earlier about perhaps a lack of scholarship, then that kind of allows people to fall back onto it. Like, oh, but there's no scholarship that says, like, we're not seeing things in academic journals that are saying that folks who identify as MENA are experiencing institutions in a different way. Therefore, we're not taking the steps, right? And so I think that we're in a interesting position because on our 2020 Student Climate for Diversity survey, we did have 5 students who identified as Middle Eastern, which was enough to not have to collapse them into like a other category, right? So then we begin to see the experiences of people who are identifying as Middle Eastern. And I feel like it maybe starts there in recognizing that 5 selected, that doesn't mean that there are only 5 students on campus, but there actually were only 5 students who wrote it in because it wasn't an option. So now we move towards, okay, the next iteration, we'll make sure that it's an option because we see that it needs to be an option. And then perhaps that begins to inform what institutional research is doing as well, and what sort of racial categories or ethnic categories they are capturing.
That is wonderful. That makes my heart so happy. And you know, the DMV has one of the largest Middle Eastern populations. You know what I mean? Like, they are here. And yes, some will write it in, but a lot might have chosen white. A lot might have chosen Asian. You have no idea. Like, I've done admission stuff and I will see a Middle Eastern looking last name and they either skip the question, they chose Asian, or I rarely actually see white chosen. And I mean, I really didn't think about it until my later high school years. And so, of course, had I had the option of Middle Eastern, I would have known to check that in high school. Of course, now in my life, I would check that. And you could totally be right. I have no idea if there is an intention, if there's no intention behind not having that category. And I don't know what frustrates me more. You know, the fact that that there's this whole population, we know there is, there's student organizations, there's groups, there's a whole language studies program at our university, but no one ever thought like maybe they should be a separate category. Or is there a reason? And what is the reason? It's really interesting. And, you know, at a large institution, it's like, who do I go to have these conversations? I wish there was one person to just snap their fingers and add this category, but that's just not how life works. Maybe it does. I don't know if you're a university out there and you're listening to this and and you have that power, contact me. But I would love, you know, what's so wrong in having that opportunity just to see if students did that. And again, UC did that. And now they have a SWANA coordinator. Now they have a space for them. Now they have, you know what I mean? Like, they have resources for them and students are using it. And that is that's a beautiful model, right? Like, that's just one institution and they did it. It's a huge system. So, you know, I don't see why Maryland or any Big Ten school or literally any school, why that couldn't be an option for them too. If we say that we care about students and supporting students, why not them?
I think that's a beautiful place for us to end, but I do want to offer you like a space to share any other final thoughts that you would like to, you know, speak on.
Those are definitely my main talking points. Yeah, I think, honestly, I just appreciate in my life more and more that people are having these conversations. I do. It makes my heart happy. I actually had a friend recently that sent me an article. I mean, this made me sad, but also happy because it was being talked about. But the article was about how, you know, when we think about COVID, we don't know how it may or may not have disproportionately affected Middle Eastern groups. It breaks my heart. You know, in California, you know, that's what the article was talking about. The hospitals there, and they were seeing in a specific community a lot of, they specifically said Arabs were losing their life or having many complications to COVID. And I was like, well, we'll never know. We'll never know how that affected this community at a large scale because nobody's talking about it. And I mean, that's not true. You know, there are definitely people. I'm not the only person on this earth or this country or even this region, I'm sure, that is doing this work. And like I said, I do see more and more, but that's my hope. Like, I really will hope and pray that by 2030, maybe we will have something. Maybe my kids will have something. And, you know, like I said, that's a big scale is the census, right? But I work in higher education. I work at a university, and there's a lot of work to be done in this area. And I think about physical spaces too, you know, something that we didn't talk about as much when I think about like things as simple as prayer spaces, right? Like, how many extra labs can we make on campus, but we can't have one extra prayer space anywhere on campus besides the student union, where everyone that's not in the center of campus, which who is, has to walk all the way over there in the middle of their day to be able to just simply pray. You know, there's a lot of things we can do at a small scale, and we can go as big as we want, right? So, you know, I really appreciate you all for having me, and it makes me so happy to hear that in your own office, you are doing what might even seem like small steps or, you know, just five students, but that's in a way groundbreaking, and it will be so impactful. And I hope that maybe other universities in Maryland, maybe the system will adopt that and take that on. And that could just be so awesome for these students.
Absolutely. I just want you to know that, like, when I saw that there were five students, it's like, yeah, yes, like, I get to include these students' experiences. And although not really seeing anything that is statistically significantly different, it's still a good starting point, and it will help to inform the way that we move forward. And then for my personal research, for my dissertation, looks at employees. And so at UMB, I made sure that Middle Eastern was a category, and there was like 9 folks who selected it. And I'm like, yes. know? So... And I mean, the numbers aren't huge, but it's enough to count people, right? It's enough to show that people are here and that they're, and then to look at how their experiences might be different from other people's experiences based off of their race or their ethnicity.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I only interviewed 5 people for my thesis, and their stories were, one of their stories was powerful enough, I felt, for there to be some sort of change, right? Because their sentiments were similar. I mean, their experience is unique, but they wanted to be seen. They wanted to be supported. And that is the message at the end of the day. And if we're committed to this work, then that needs to be part of this conversation.
The Table is a production of the Intercultural Center and the Division of Student Affairs at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. It's hosted and produced by Courtney Jones Carney and Rosemary Ferreira. This episode was also written by Rosemary. The show's executive producer and editor is me, Angela Jackson, Senior Marketing Specialist in the Division of Student Affairs. A big thank you to our guest, Sama Sabihi, for joining us at The Table. For more information about the Intercultural Center, including events where students can learn more about race, ethnicity, culture, norms, and current events, visit umaryland.edu/ILE. Thanks for listening. See you next time.